Alors, rebonjour tout le monde. Si vous pouvez prendre vos places. Good afternoon, everyone. If you'd like to take your places, we have a really full agenda this afternoon. Three presentations slash panels that will end this conference on the future of the humanities, futur des sciences humaines. Et on commence cet après-midi avec une présentation de Normand Labry. Présentation qui devrait nous dresser un peu le portrait du futur des sciences humaines au Canada. Et le professeur Labry est très bien placé pour nous faire part de ces défis, puisqu'il a été, jusqu'au 1er mai de cette année, le directeur scientifique des Fonds de recherche du Québec, Société et Culture, et avant ça, était le doyen associé pour les études supérieures à la Faculté d'éducation de l'Université de Toronto. So this afternoon, we are very privileged to have Normand Labry with us to kick off this afternoon's activities. In this first panel, he'll be talking to us about the significance and the future of humanities in Canada. And Professor Labry is very well placed to be able to speak to us about this because he was, until May 1st, the scientific director of the Fonds de recherche du Québec Société et Culture. For those of you who aren't from Quebec, this is the largest granting organization here for the social sciences and humanities, and is very much a lifeblood for most of the researchers throughout the province of Quebec in all of our major research universities. Prior to that, Professor Labry was the Associate Dean for Research and Graduate Studies at the Faculty of Education at the University of Toronto, which is known to many of you, that faculty, as the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education. Professor Labry and I share something. We're both graduates of Université Laval, though I'm not quite sure. We were trying to figure out who were there at the same time. But while he was at Laval, Dr. Labry completed a PhD in linguistics and also a postdoctoral fellowship at the Research Center on Multilingualism and at the Catholic University in Brussels. And in fact, he has maintained those links with Belgium as he is the Canadian representative for the Intergovernmental Committee for UNESCO, and also was granted the Medal of the Order of the Pléiade, the Parliamentary Assembly of Francophonie in Luxembourg. So he is well known to the Francophone community, not only here in Canada, but very much across the Francophonie du monde. So I'd like you to join me in welcoming Dr. Labry. Merci.
Alors, bonjour tout le monde. Voilà. I'm sorry, I won't dance, I won't act, I will talk to you. It's hard to come at the end of a two-day conference after the great show we had just before lunch, and also after all the discussions we had over the last 2 days, where I feel that most of what I'm going to say has been said already, but maybe I will just summarize a few of the things that were said, and also give some many precisions on some of my thoughts on the topic as well. Let me start maybe with a couple of quotes here from different organizations that took a stance on the importance and significance of social humanities, of social sciences and humanities. For example, Harvard College, in a report on the Mapping the Future of the Humanities, writes about the importance of arts and humanities. They teach us how to describe experience, how to evaluate it, and how to imagine its liberating transformation. The Leiden statement of it's a group of organizations involved in university organizations like the U15 from Canada, but also the UK group of universities, the Group of Eight in Australia, all got together and signed a statement about the importance of social sciences and humanities, and it says that they are indispensable to understand and addressing contemporary global challenges and grasping emerging opportunities. And every challenge the world faces has a human dimension, and no solution can be achieved without enlisting the support and efforts of individuals, communities, and societies. Following this publication of the statement, the U15 also released a press release, and where it states that for the Canadian society, we are going to need to mobilize support of the, for the social sciences as we did already for the STEM, for the science, technical, engineering, and medical disciplines. And currently in France as well, the Athena Alliance, the group of organizations that deal with social sciences and humanities, just published a small book on the science within science. It's about social sciences and humanities, its importance. We all seem to agree, I think there is a consensus here, that social sciences and humanities are very important for the future, but we all need to state it. And this is, I think, a question we have to ask ourselves. Why is it that we all need to make a statement about it? Why isn't that given for granted? And maybe one of the, I think there may be reasons for that. We should, I guess, investigate that more in depth through research. One of my hypotheses would be maybe that we feel that there is a need for social sciences and humanities, but the funding that goes with it is not at the level that it should be. If I take the Quebec universities, for example, 50% of the faculty members are in the social sciences and humanities. So from 10,000 faculty members in Quebec, 5,000 work in the social sciences and humanities. Graduate students in Quebec, full-time, 40,000 graduate students, and half of them, a little bit more than half of them, are in the social sciences and humanities. So it's half of the community, university community in Quebec that is in the social sciences and humanities. If you look at the funding for research, from the $1.8 billion of funding coming for research to the universities, to the 18 universities, the portion for social sciences and humanities is 10%, so it's $182 million. And so that is a small portion. So the half of the community just reallocates itself, like 10% of the overall funding. So I think if we have to state that over and over again, we're all convinced here in that room. I don't think I did change the mind of somebody in the room by repeating those statements. We all agree on that. But if we do need to repeat them all the time, I guess there is a reason, and that could be related. Transforming the graduate education, if we want to do that today, it requires to start reflecting about the significance of the humanities in maybe 10, 20, and 30 years from now. And we need to take into account the emerging needs of society, but also the aspirations of the future generations of students. And that's what I will try to do in the next few minutes. My presentation is based, it's not based on empirical data, a study of that topic, but I draw from the literature on the topic, and it's based also on my experience and interest as Associate Dean for Graduate Education in a Faculty of Education for many years, and my recent experience at the Fonds de Recherche du Québec, where we did also organize a symposium 2 years ago on the training in the area of research in Quebec. Talking about 10, 20, 30 years from now is a little bit risky, but I think we still can make some assumptions upon the conditions in which future graduate studies students will in the humanities will operate in the future in that time period. If we start to transform the doctoral programs, the requirements today, we start discussions within departments, faculties, universities. It will take probably 10 years until the programs are transformed. We recruit and admit new students. The students complete their requirements and do graduate. So we won't be able to measure any effect of what we're talking about today until 10 years from now. So that's why talking about 10, 20, or 30 years from now is closer maybe to reality than fiction. And we need to start acting right now. Chad Gaffield yesterday presented the data on the evolution of the population that obtained the PhD degree in Canada over the last decades. If we focus here on the last 20 years from 1991 to 2011, according to Statistics Canada, we went from 83,000 Canadians who had a PhD degree to 161 Canadians who have that. So we doubled the number, and we also doubled the proportion. It was less than 0.5%. It was 0.4% of the population 20 years ago. It has increased to 0.9%. So roughly we have 1% of the population right now who has a PhD degree in Canada. And that's through students who did acquire their PhD here, but also through immigration, because we try to attract talent to the country. So that's not the only, it's not just by offering PhDs, it's also by accepting new immigrants with PhDs to Canada. So if we project for 20 years from now, I think it would be a conservative estimate to say that within 20 years from now, we should probably increase from 1 to 2% of the population with a PhD. So the big question is that too many PhDs? And that's already a question we have now. Are we going to have too many people with PhD degrees? A small and even smaller portion than today would be involved, of that 2% would be involved in the academia, academic employment, teaching, research, and service. But for the larger portion of the population with a PhD degree, they will be involved in other kinds of activities in different agencies, governments, companies, NGOs, etc. So that would be a highly educated group of people who will have acquired a set of skills, would have qualities and expertise. And again, without engaging in futurology, I think we can project from now on what those skills, what this expertise and quality should be if we want to address the major issues of societies that are coming up. And I think we can also start engineering those skills, qualities, and also expertise. The evolution of our society depends heavily on highly educated people. Currently, Canadian population is very urbanized. 80% of the Canadian population lives in large cities. Households are connected to the internet. 82% were connected in 2012. The structure of the economy of Canada as well, like today, less than 10% of the jobs are in the manufacturing sector. Almost 80% are in the service sector. So that all speaks for the importance of social sciences and humanities in currently and also in the next decades. Many countries around the world have adopted this economic strategy that is based on becoming competitive as a knowledge society. We've heard yesterday about Ontario that doubled the number of graduate students in a recent time. As a matter of fact, Ontario has set an objective for the current decade to increase the population 25 to 64 year old with some post-secondary education from 63 to 70%. So by 2020, we should reach that in Ontario. In China, in 2010, the Politburo had adopted a policy that would bring up and give access to its population to post-secondary education from 33 to 60% of the population. And India has also a target to move up from 13% to 30% of its population with post-secondary education by 2030. So we're not alone in the world with that, I think, kind of approach, where education is extremely important, and graduate education is key for the our competitiveness as a knowledge society. The education of that 2% of the Canadian population that would be highly educated, would have those skills, qualities, and expertise, I think will respond to broad issues which cannot be predicted, but they can be projected, I think. And there has been a few operations in the world to try to project what will be the main issues that we will face in the next decades. And one of that initiative is has been made in Europe with the 2020 Horizon 2020 framework for the policy for research. SHRC has done a thorough consultation across the country over the last few years to identify the big challenges for the future of Canada. The Quebec government has done thorough consultations also in the last couple of years to develop a national policy on research and innovation. So all these give us a bit of a glimpse of the major issues we'll face in the next decades and where social scientists and people in the humanities will have a role to play. And let's just look at the seven societal challenges presented by Europe in the Horizon 2020 framework. So big questions like health, demographic change and well-being, food security, sustainable agriculture and forestry, marine, maritime and inland water research and bioeconomy, secure, clean and efficient energy, and so on and so on. So these are questions that I'd say are so big, so complex, that I think nobody will tell us that we won't need 2% of the population ready to deal with all those questions in 5-10 years from now. I think this is obvious. Same thing with the six future challenges identified by SHRC and its operation on the future of Canada. What new ways of learning, particularly in higher education, will Canadians need in order to thrive in an evolving society and labor market? What effects will the quest for energy and natural resources have on our society and our position in the world stage? How are the experiences and aspirations of Aboriginal peoples in Canada essential to building a successful shared future? What might the implications of global peak population be for Canada, and so on? So these, again, are questions where we won't be able to address all those important questions with all their complexities with a tiny portion of the population, a few people who would have done a PhD and would be able to do that. I think 2% would probably be a reasonable target. In Quebec, National Policy on Research and Innovation, three major societal challenges have been identified. The first one on demographic change, and it was mainly based on aging, but also the mobility of people, the migration, immigration, and so forth. Sustainable development and identity. And there has been a shift of governments and policies, but the current government has put on hold some of the implementation of that policy on research and innovation. But nevertheless, the current government also identifies crucial issues for the society in Quebec where there is a need to invest in research, and those are, for example, all connected with those major questions, such as the northern development of the province, the maritime strategy, radicalization, which is currently a hot issue in Quebec, bullying in education, and so forth. So I think these are also issues where we need to prepare the next generation of scholars who need time to get their degrees, go through their programs, and become the next cohort of people who will help governments, the state, and organizations, and the society to evolve in the right direction. I think there is no doubt that we have a real need to prepare a good portion of our population to develop the qualities, expertise, and skills to conceptualize problems related to those broad challenges, to entangle the complexity of many interrelated phenomena, from social nature, technological, individual. Understand and explain their origin, their cause, their consequences, and help propose solutions, their implementation, their measurement, and debate about all this in a critical manner, rational manner, and based on evidence. The qualities needed by this 2% of the population will include an ease in collaboration, capacity to communicate efficiently, great creativity. The expertise they will need will include expert knowledge based on a body of knowledge and the ability to appreciate tools, various methodologies, and use sophisticated tools to do the research on those aspects. And the skills needed will include leadership, management, pedagogy. The pressure comes from society to have a group of people who have those skills and expertise, but also from the population itself, from the students. More than half of the current graduate population in Canada, in Canadian universities, choose social sciences and humanities. So why do they choose social and humanities? They want to understand the human condition, and they wish to contribute to improve the human condition, and they wish to transform society. Considering the huge challenges that have been identified, there is no reason why those pressures would not be maintained and maybe reinforced in the next decade or so. The pressures also come from the industry, all the economic activity sectors that exploit resources, produce goods and services, and produce wealth. I think they all have that need as well. They will need a workforce who has those skills, that expertise. So what are the attributes of the that subset of graduate population who will have completed doctoral studies in the social sciences and the humanities? I would situate those attributes on a continuum composed of two aspects based on the broad reasons why people engage in higher education. On one end, the Bildung concept, which is the self-cultivation, people who want to do further study for increased culture, higher level of thinking, increased knowledge, understanding, and a greater sense of citizenship. And on the other side of the continuum, employability. And the motivation for that is to acquire appropriate professional skills, serve a profession, serve a population, serve an economic sector, and make a living for oneself. And both ends of that continuum, I think, are very legitimate for students to consider. The strength of the graduates in the social sciences and humanities resides in their capacity to understand, explain, and help shape cultural, social, economic, and political realities and technologies. They are aware of the fact that those realities are created realities and that they exist amidst tensions, and they are most often in a state of continuous transformation. So the strength is to be able to consider all that and to process that. And they also have the ability to understand what and maybe use the technologies associated to those realities. Technologies with a capital T, such as domination and power, resistance, manipulation, play, and also technologies with a small T, such as speech, writing, discourse, image and sound, and information communication technology. So the graduates have that. This is, I think, their toolkit. I think they can work with that, and they know what to do out of it. On the Bildung side of the continuum, the graduates in social sciences and humanities bring a deep, multi-layered, interdependency-based understanding of realities. And on the other side, other end of the continuum, the employability, they bring a capacity to analyze, follow, and orient social change and cultural change. They have the capacity to adopt an objective stance in considering the social change and cultural change, and to document and explain its transformation, and to help out changing and shaping that change. They do so by using techniques, their knowledge, and their expertise. And all this can be instrumentalized somehow by public agencies, employers, industry, and as such they can contribute to the development of public policy, organizations, industries, professional practice, and organizations. The graduates in the social sciences and humanities have the capacity to consider realities and technologies from a critical point of view, not taking things for granted, and exerting reasonable doubt, and drawing from a scientific approach. And these critical capacity can be formulated from different perspectives, social perspectives, legal, economic, ethical, philosophical, anthropological. So the 2% of the population who graduates with a PhD will have, on one side, in-depth disciplinary knowledge, and on the other side, cross-cutting transversal competencies. The first element of this equation, which has more to do with the expertise than with qualities and skills, must be considered maybe in greater detail. The big question is, for the future of doctoral studies, how much in-depth disciplinary knowledge should be expected and required from doctoral students in the future? We are at a crossroad now where it's clear that the graduate needs a fair balance between in-depth disciplinary knowledge and cross-cutting transversal skills. And Chad Gaffield presented a figure yesterday with a T, the T-bar, that represents that. A natural reaction from the academia is to add light requirements in the area of transversal skills as a complement to the traditional disciplinary expertise expected from a graduate. But as we have heard here from students yesterday and after the during the discussions, the workload of both faculty members and students is already quite heavy, and the time to graduation is already too long. So a fair balance between the two will not be achieved unless the requirements in terms of disciplinary knowledge will be substantially transformed and eventually reduced. And this is, I think, the big challenge in the academia, to consider that the academic requirements could be eventually reduced, but necessarily transformed. Maybe a better way at looking at things, rather than say let's diminish let's not diminish the academic requirements, let's resist that, is to look at focus on the significance of expertise and its new manifestations in the current knowledge society. We went, I would say, from a what I would call a monopolistic model of knowledge production, where 50 years ago, when 0.4% of the population had a PhD degree, so the happy few who had the PhD were scholars who had appropriated knowledge and became the experts in their field, being the only ones to dispose of that body of knowledge. Their main infrastructure for that's blocked up. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Their main Their main infrastructure for knowledge in universities 50 years ago would have been libraries, where knowledge was accumulated, maintained, curated, and the scholar, accomplished scholar, would be the person who detained and mastered a large body of knowledge and became recognized as the expert. And the current requirements for the PhD thesis still reflects a little bit that kind of idea of a monopolistic knowledge model. But I would oppose that to the current distributed model of knowledge, where knowledge exists in various parts of society. For example, the university library is one infrastructure among many, many others. There are other kinds of infrastructure that help produce and disseminate knowledge. Knowledge is distributed across the board in society in different places, not just at the university level. And the role of the scholar is not only to produce new knowledge, but also to access knowledge, to assess it, to appropriate it for oneself, to challenge it, to operationalize it. And this is another way of looking at what is an expert today. Not somebody who has a monopoly on knowledge, but someone who shares their skills and expertise with the rest of the society. So that has implications for the conception and delivery of the doctoral programs if we adopt that kind of distributed knowledge model as opposed to monopolistic. And the role of researchers in social sciences and humanities is not only to produce new knowledge, which will be shared with the rest of society, but also to produce new knowledge in symbiosis with the communities which are part of this process of researching from and within communities and for the communities themselves. We've talked about the co-creation of knowledge here earlier in the symposium. That's, I think, how we should envisage the transformation of PhD and the requirements that go with the kind of in-depth knowledge that is needed, so much more related to a distributed model of knowledge rather than monopolistic. What is most problematic for transforming graduate studies in the social sciences and humanities is precisely situated at the Bildung end of the continuum. It has to do with the depth of the in-depth disciplinary knowledge, how much depth should we consider when we establish our requirements. On the employability end of the continuum, the appropriation of cross-cutting transversal competencies covers a wide range of qualities, expertise, and skills, including leadership, team management, project management, ethics, budget, communication, pedagogy, collaboration, interdisciplinarity. Many of these competencies have been examined in the last decade, 10 years, by Vitae in the UK, by in a study by APEC Deloitte in France, the Group of Eight in Australia. No doubt they are an asset for the graduate in the social sciences and humanities. The question is more how to connect these to in-depth disciplinary knowledge. And the real difficult question, it's a real difficult question because it's not just a matter of adding on. It's not by adding new courses required in the programs that we can address that. It's by introducing a different way of conducting and assessing doctoral research. Doctoral education and the distributed knowledge model requires we develop the means to evaluate this form of production of knowledge, as demonstrated by a doctoral candidate who is involved in the collective and collaborative production of knowledge. So this is more complex than evaluating a PhD, a thesis that has been done as a single researcher in isolation. Another question is how to transform the programs to take into account the new profiles of the generation of students, which is different from the one we used to know. Going from 0.4%, the happy few, to 2% means major considerations. We've talked yesterday about mental health, the funding question, and equity, giving access to other people than just that happy few of the past. New types of knowledge which are valued, new media and stocking for sharing knowledge, and the new societal challenges. So that's where all those areas need, I think, to be taken into account. And this in an institution, the university, which faces currently a fiscal crisis and in some cases almost legitimacy crisis in the society. So new parameters must be found. We must target the right number of or portion of population for whom it's worth investing public and individual resources to achieve graduate education in the social sciences and humanities. We must rationalize the admission processes, the retention mechanisms, the financial and human support, and reduce the graduation time. In short, we must revisit the requirements, the academic requirements. We must also rethink the requirements along those attributes on the side of qualities, expertise, and skills by finding the right balance between the Bildung and the employability continuum I talked about. Those parameters must be consistent with the changing nature of research, the complexity of problems faced by society, governments, and business, the greater rapidity with which understanding and solving issues is expected in our societies, the interconnectivity of things, the complex regulatory frameworks at the national, local level, and the internationalization of research problems and research conduct, and the collective nature of team research and partnerships. So in the last minutes, just asking, where do we go from here? Much work has been done already. And I just give three examples, for example. The Group of Eight in Australia has done a report on the changing PhD. They identified the potential attributes of the PhD graduate, and they along five different areas, the disciplinary knowledge, research skills, technical skills and knowledge, contribution to knowledge and generic skills. I won't go into the details, but if you access that report, there are lots of subsets of skills there, which are, I think, worth considering if we modify the PhD programs and their requirements. For example, in the domain of disciplinary knowledge, a sub-question would be an understanding of the various ways in which the discipline can have direct or indirect impact on national well-being. But I won't go into the details here. The MLA Task Force on Doctoral Study has been mentioned many times over the last 2 days also. I think they did an outstanding job at identifying the goals that must be pursued, which are important ones, to pursue and maintain academic excellence, which doesn't mean that you don't modify the way you see things, but by transforming things, but keeping in as one of the goals the excellence. Preserve and extend the accessibility for matters of equity. Broaden career paths, focus on graduate students' needs. That's a no-brainer, but it has been mentioned also here, but it has to be put up front. And they made 9 recommendations to redesign the doctoral programs, engage more deeply with technology, reimagine the dissertation. So I think all the ingredients are here to move forward with solutions to modify the programs. They also have as a recommendation to reduce time to degree to an optimum of 5 years, possibly. And finally, the Fonds de Recherche Québec had a symposium here at McGill 2 years ago on research training, and we identified a few, we had a few conclusions I can just talk about here. One of the problems in Quebec is the length of the master's level. Students take quite long to complete a master's degree. And this is related, I guess, to the competitivity to obtain scholarships and funding for the PhD degree. So you'd rather stay longer at the master's level to publish and get a better CV to be able to have scholarships. And the attrition rate for the doctoral studies, which is 50% like in many other places. Students should be considered as researchers who contribute really to the advancements of research. The measures should be taken to improve research training that meets principles of flexibility, more mobility across institutions, and more individuality as well for customized programs and customized training for students themselves. Supervision should be seen as a collective effort and not an individual effort, one-to-one. There should be more possibility to also work between the supervision team and the student by agreeing on the training plan and a strategy between like a contract between the students and the university and the program. So these are some of the conclusions that symposium came to. So just to conclude now, these are many other initiatives like the white paper here also is another one, all point in the same direction. We need to act and to modify the programs and their requirements. We need to act now because it's only in 10 years from now that we'll feel the outcome of the changes we will introduce right now. So that is, I think, the main message I had to deliver. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup, Normand. I have a mic that can be a roving mic, but we do have two stationary mics in the right. We have about 20 minutes for questions. Thank you very much. We have been talking about the importance of the social sciences and the humanities, and we've been talking a lot about the change. But you've kind of brought it together in terms of an action plan. So that's a good way to end up in this final afternoon in plenary. So on avait des questions ici. These are the roving mics. They will come to you. That's even easier. Wow.
I'll start us off here. Leslie Cormack, the University of Alberta. As you were talking about the contributions that the humanities, social sciences, and fine arts can make to our society, one of the things that seems to have been missing, not just from what you were saying, but also what we've been talking about, is what I might characterize as the just society, although I hesitate to use that term in Quebec, but also the whole imperative of, you know, how ought we to live? Who are we as human beings? And I do think, I mean, I worry that discourse is also not part of our political world right now either, which is probably why it's not there. But I think it's such an important part of what we do, particularly in the humanities, and it's so fundamental to us living in a world we want to live in. And so I want us to somehow encourage, you know, have that as part of the discourse as well.
Well, thank you to pointing to that. And I think when I talked about the continuum Bildung versus employability, I think in the Bildung aspect, this is something very important that I didn't go into those details, but yeah, I think it's important that you point to that.
Merci, Normand. Because of the 10-year, it's chilling to...
Okay.
it's chilling to be reminded that anything we... Even if we could do it today, you know, we would only be able to measure the effects plausibly, you know, 10 years, so maybe like two overlapping cohorts, maybe three if we made radical changes that quickened the pace. And that's just the PhD, but not even effects on professoriate, right? So how do we institutionally approach this really long-term project if, you know, plausibly, whatever we do, you know, we're talking 20 years to see what we've done right and what we've done wrong?
Thank you, Frederick. I think conducting research on that, too, like that was one of the recommendations also of the symposium of the Fonds de Recherche du Québec to document the changes and not, maybe not wait until 10 years from now to start evaluating what happened, but to start evaluating and producing more data about the sector of higher education and the graduate studies in education. For example, in Switzerland, they transformed the PhD where they moved from academic concept of the PhD, traditional academic one, to a PhD which is more to prepare a generation of professional researchers. And that has been accompanied by a research project right from beginning where everything was being documented as it unfolded, so they didn't wait for the 10 years to get results. And what they found out, for example, was that a study by Nicole Reguet-Collet was that faculty members resisted that shift, and students were very happy about the shift. So students got exactly the kind of education they wanted, but the faculty members were not happy with preparing professionals of research. They had in their habitus the preparation of the next generation of academics. So that was documented, and I think through the outcomes and the publications about that, I think it helped to understand what's happening and maybe to help find solutions and not wait too long until we get there. I think it's probably that the research could be probably the best way to make coherent effort from the institutional level, at the institutional level, to start documenting and researching the phenomenon. That's maybe the only way I would see.
Thank you so much for that, Normal. I wanted to ask you about the distributed knowledge model, which I agree with, and how we think about it in relationship to the role of the university in society and in relationship to the reform of graduate education. Yesterday, Jade McDougall made clear to us, and I guess we understood this already, that First Nations culture is not an object of study, but a form of knowledge that we have to take into account and dialogue with. Today I learned that hip-hop culture is also not merely an object of study, but a form of knowledge, a way of seeing the world in a fairly complex, skilled way, as well as a powerful form of public making. Where does that leave the university in this network of distributed knowledge, and how do we rethink the university and graduate education?
Yeah, well, okay, good question. The fact that we are sensitive to that, that we have an awareness of that knowledge is not our monopoly anymore, I think that's already an important shift to make. This is great. I think the knowledge is distributed, like is available for the world, all populations. There is lots of knowledge available now through the internet and through other things. There is a recognition that practitioners, professionals have knowledge also on how to do things. There is this very strong movement about First Nation knowledge and traditional knowledge, which is also as a value per se. I think the first step is probably to recognize that. I think, and this probably is being done, if not accomplished already in the university. I think this is the first step. The way we conduct research in partnership in the practice environments, in the communities themselves, with a sense of not researching on them, but researching with them, for them as well. I think that's the conception of how you frame your research. And all the new ways of sharing and disseminating knowledge now that have been developed through the technologies. I think we depend on technology a lot, and technologies bring us in certain directions, depending on the capacity of those technologies. But that I think this is happening more and more. So it's easier now to share knowledge with other means. That, and I think that those possibilities are not a monopoly of the university anymore. So the university is a player in that new ecosystem. So I think by I think that's what I would have to say on that.
Thank you.
Emma Lang, Memorial University. I guess I would like to respectfully disagree that it will take 10 years. I think, first of all, we don't have 10 years. I think growing up in an academic household, in an academic community, I think a lot of the things that we've been discussing have been discussed throughout my life, and I just turned 30. And I see that, and I know that we also, I think what really comes down to, and I think this is what the graduate students were talking about, and I hope that no one will mind if I sort of try and speak a little bit for coming out of our discussion, is that these are changes that a lot of them are very simple to begin to implement on our own campuses, and that what we are as a group asking of the people in this room is to really go back to campuses and start to implement them, even if it's on a very small scale, because at this point, I think it's, and I don't want to sound melodramatic or whiny, and I know this might sound a bit of both, but I think we've really gone too far, and I think we need to just start, you know, just start acting on our, jumping in, and well, yes, I think, and I also think that if we do that, the changes will become visible, but I also think it will help things that as a group, we all really want to do, which is make sure that our enrollment, we're getting the enrollment that we want, either in numbers or populations. And if we start to slowly implement these already, the changes will be visible instantaneously in the quality of life in our departments, not just amongst graduate students, but also among faculty and administrators, and also amongst staff. I mean, I know that many of us were discussing how much our the graduate secretaries in our department, you know, they've supported all of us so much. So I just would say that it's not 10 years. I think it can be now, and maybe that's a bit of youth, but I also think it's true.
In other words, how to allow that graduate students don't become just an object of study in this particular transformation. I think that's what.
Thanks.
We have a question here.
Hi. Yeah. Eliza Bateman, McGill University, formerly of the Australian National University, which was one of the group of eight schools involved in that report. I just want to say something very quick about that, which was the group of eight report is fantastic, but actually in the process of writing that report, and since the ANU has cut its humanities department completely and subsumed it within a school of cultural inquiry that's almost entirely languages-based. So I feel that that's an important sort of subtext to part of that report. Humanities funding's also been cut in Australia by 20% in the last 5 years. But one thing I wanted to say that was positive in response to what Emma said, and thank you very much, was that on the list of all the suggestions that you had from the report about how faculties could transform, talking about collaborative supervision, students being seen as researchers, not students, a lot of these ideas were brought up by the graduate students yesterday and presented. So I feel that that's fantastic that that's what's actually coming out, and we are on track with the things that we want and we need, and we know that maybe that's something we can get.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Patsy Badir from the University of British Columbia. In BC, we've seen a recent flurry of policy statements from the provincial government directing education institutions from kindergarten through to post-secondary education to focus its new initiatives on the emerging resource economy, which means the LNG industry in BC. A lot of the rhetoric that we've seen around this kind of stuff talks about, you know, sort of mobilizing new ideas, new knowledges in order to shape the future. And I guess I see a slippage between the rhetoric that is coming to us from the provincial government in BC and the rhetoric that is coming that we ourselves are generating in our thinking about reimagining doctoral education. And I guess the question that I want to ask is something like how do we assure that the changes that we make inform government policy rather than are simply informed by them? Because I see a danger of a slip there.
Mm-hmm. So how to avoid the gang of eight? Is it the group of eight or the gang of eight? How to avoid that phenomenon that it happened in Australia?
Well, I think it's a dialogue between the academia and the public administrations, I guess, that is ongoing and that needs to be maintained. I think there is the mutual influences goes on both sides, and governments have maybe the power to make decisions, but those decisions never come out of the blue. I think they are the outcome of dialogic conversations that take place. So I think the more we will be, if we increase to 2% of the population with that kind of education, maybe we'll have a little bit more influence in that dialogic conversation with the governments. But I think we won't be able to impose our views necessarily. I don't think so. That's not the way things work. But keep on, be part of that dialogue, I think. It's important.
Erica Stevens-Abbott, University of Windsor. As I listen to the responses to your incredibly comprehensive journey, I too feel a really strong yearning for some language we're not hearing. We talk about research, PhDs going out into the world, but I'm not. And we hear about relations between disciplines and between generations, but I'm not hearing what for me is really important: that relation between the PhD and emerging PhD, and not just the production of knowledge, but the transmission of it. How we do what we do, how we transmit what we've learned about what we do, the insights that we have, how we teach that to PhD students, how PhD students become those professors. I guess I'm talking about, oh, should I just say it out loud, teaching? And being a public intellectual, which is another dirty phrase now, maybe, but a thinker, you know, we'll think for food. Somebody called that a philosopher once. But the notion that what we're doing is not just research. I hear research a lot, but I'm not hearing the relational mm-hmm. aspect of research mm-hmm. and how it impacts society, just or not, good or not, mm-hmm. what it does. And it's in there. It's in what you've said. Mm-hmm. But it's when you say Bildung and other aspects of, you know, our affiliation to what we do and how it helps the individual. I'm not hearing the communitarian view of how we transmit how we're going to deal with the world in the future. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And surely that's part of our duty of care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I won't be able to respond right now on that, but yeah, that's a very important question you're raising.
I think this will be our last question.
Merci, Normand. What you've laid out very quietly, but you've laid out quite a radical transformation agenda for us. And I'm wondering where do you see the most likely vectors of change? Is it down at each of our individual campus? Is something that you see from that the learned societies are members of the Federation? And by the way, I'm Jean-Marc Mangin from the Federation. That could play a role in reshaping what's the expectations of what's excellent scholarship in disciplines and drives like what the MLE has done in the States. Granting agencies, we had Chad yesterday again, and with you too, it's fascinating. People have been inside and outside, and you come out with change is possible, change is needed now. And then you laid out an agenda, but how do we get started?
Yeah, I think if you try to look at the resistance first, that's what I would do. And I think the resistance is very local in the academia, among those small committees that define the future of the programs. And I think there is real resistance there. I am in a program where we are. Outstanding faculty of education and outstanding program, but my colleagues are talking now about adding additional required courses for the program because students would need more courses. I think this is completely in the opposite direction of where we should be going. But that's the reflex of the academia right now. So what can help just move forward in other directions? As you're right, the Federation and the associations can have a positive impact on the local decision makers, I think, when they relate to their organizations, national or international organizations. The funding agencies, you're right as well, with the I think in the long term, they I don't think the funding agencies are in a position to either, like to make quick changes. I think that's always in the 2, 3, 5, 10 years span of time where you can introduce change. I think the conditions for eligibility or the criteria for the evaluation of certain aspects of scholarship applications or research applications can be modified, but that's done over time, and that can make it possible to sensibilize the community about the importance of certain aspects, the collaborative research, for example, non-traditional trajectories for students, for example, as well. So that can be valued besides the typical criteria of excellence or GPA or things like this. So these are ways. And I think the crucial thing is the hiring of new faculty members in universities. So that's if universities hire students with a very traditional path, I think that perpetuates the traditional path. If they hire as new hire students who took the risks of doing creative research and in a different way, I think then that will have a quicker effect, I think, on the overall change. But that's a risk that often the students have to take themselves. So that's a problem.
Thank you, Normand. One of the things that you mentioned in your talk was the aspect of legitimacy. And I think that's something else that's come out in the questions, the idea that this process is, in effect, being not pushed, but engendered by the sense of the crisis of legitimacy, in some respects, in the social sciences and humanities, but also this idea that if we're going to embark in a process of change, it has to be seen as one of legitimacy as well by the community itself going forward. So thank you very much for your insights, and someone said for your very comprehensive survey of the landscape at this time. Merci beaucoup, merci. Normand Labrie. I think Paul Yakna would like to say that we have a pause now, a break, and then we are coming back for two roundtables.
We'll take a 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and come back for a roundtable doing the humanities in public.